Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You know, I just wanted to do something on my own. I mean, it was great at Saatchi's because you could do anything there. You had total freedom, as long as you didn't get any public credit for it. And, I thought about what my dad had said, and he was still alive at that time, and I thought it would just be good to have a go. I'd made a little bit of money, and I borrowed £250,000.
Sir Martin Sorrell is arguably the most important advertising executive in the world. As CEO of WPP Group, he oversees a global marketing machine that he's assembled over more than 30 years. His group companies include J. Walter Thompson and Ogilvy & Mather, Young & Rubicam, and more than 100 others. Clients include two of every three global Fortune 500 companies. This is Fort Knox, Rich Ideas and Powerful People. It's a weekly podcast bringing you the highest achievers from business, entertainment, philanthropy, and sport. We're going to learn how the very best climb to the top and pull out lessons along the way. If that sounds good to you, make this a habit. Subscribe on Apple's podcast app or Google Play. And once you've done that, tell a friend. These talks are definitely conversation starters. When I sat down with Sorrell for the Fort Knox podcast, I wanted to talk about his childhood, his career, and the pivotal choices he made. He didn't disappoint. Here's Sir Martin Sorrell.
Sir Martin, I think it's just phenomenal.
It is
that
phenomenal. You're dead right,
you
John.
You have built this company.
And I haven't built it on my own. There's a couple hundred thousand other people that have been there.
But Wire and Plastic Products,
right,
is what the shell of it was called, 1985, right? It's been more than 30 years. And you did it, at age 40?
I started when I was age 40, so I'm now 72, yes.
Yeah.
Male menopause, as they call it. Andropause is
technical disorder. Not a lot of people build something this big, granted not all by yourself, but even with help, at that point.
It'd be interesting. I don't know. I haven't gone back and looked at how many people sort of got the call at around that age. I mean, 40 is in those days... used to be a pretty critical age because you think of yourself starting work when you're about 20, you come out of college, and finishing when you're 60. Now, of course, here I am at 72, still going. And you know what, I'm comparing myself to Warren Buffett, but he's 86, and Jorge Lehman is 75, 76,
and he still does.
Charlie Munger, I think, is even older than the Warren. But in those days, 40 years old, I think probably it's a little bit later now, maybe 45 is the critical age. And I mean, Jeremy Bullmore, who still, I think, is the best writer in the advertising industry, who used to be the chairman of J. Walter Thompson in London, sort of said to me that, you know, you should put a little flag on everybody's PC 3 months from their 40th birthday, because that's when they're thinking about what they're going to do for the next 20 years as opposed to the first 20. That's what happened to me. I sort of look back. Look forward, and my dad had always said, you know, build a reputation in find a company that you enjoy, in an industry you enjoy, build a reputation with it, and if you fancy doing something on your own, go off and do it, but don't flit from flower to flower, which of course is the conventional wisdom now, is that you're better off looking at all sort of going from company to company and building experience that way.
So you've said that you've never had a closer friend or confidant than your father.
Yeah, and unlikely to have, yes.
What made the relationship so special?
Well, I guess I was an only child. I had an older brother, Michael, who died at birth, was what they called then a dry birth. So that was in 1944, when the war was still going on. I was sort of born in 1945, February the 14th, 1945. So I think, you know, I came from a Jewish family in northwest London, in what I call the ghetto of northwest London, and I was a spoilt only child, only Jewish kids, boys or girls know what it is to have a possessive Jewish mother. I had a mother who wrapped everything in plastic, and it was amazing I didn't end up in a plastic bag in the fridge.
So very different from how your father grew up.
Yes. Well, I mean, to this day, I don't know. I mean, I knew my Zayda and my Bubba, as we used to call them. My grandmother on my father's side was a very strong-willed woman who died of breast cancer, because in those days, Orthodox Jewish women would never go to a doctor to be examined. Maybe that's still the case, I think. But I was, you know, I was an only child of, or probably even worse, I had a brother who died, and therefore I was the last chance saloon. And so I probably had a very close relationship with my father and my mother. My mother was very possessive, and, you know, to her dying day, she used to work in a charity, and she died when she was almost 90. We buried her on her 90th birthday. Mm. But she worked in a Jewish charity, and I think she was in the reception center of the largest Jewish day care center in Europe. So she used to do the reception of all these old people who would come in for their daily fix.
Yeah.
No, not fix, literally, but metaphorically.
Right.
And she would bore them rigid with stories about her son, her one and only, and her grandchildren, even worse.
So your father and mother were close to you, took close care of you, and you went to Cambridge.
Yes, I went to Cambridge. I mean, my father was very keen on me having a good education, because he didn't, as I said, he had to leave school when he was 13. He got a violin scholarship to the Royal School of Music, which he couldn't take up because he, as I say, had to become an income producing unit. My mother met him at school. They were childhood sweethearts at secondary school. So my dad was very keen for me to have a good education, and I went to what was called an indirect grant grammar school in the UK, which called Haberdashers, which was the best of the state system and the best of the private system. My father paid, I was a fee-paying student, or he paid for my fees. It was £30 per term, and there were three terms of the year, so the education cost him £90 a year, which in those days, it was a day school, was a lot. And that gave me a good chance of getting into Cambridge, which I did do, to study economics, to wrestle with economics, literally, at Christ College, Cambridge, and I went there.
So when you went to Saatchi,
yeah,
eventually, as CFO,
yes,
was it more about the economics part, or was it more about the...
Oh, it was serendipity, none of the above, because in between, I went from Cambridge straight to Harvard Business School, which my mother thought was the worst thing that I could have ever done.
Why?
Well, she thought it made me into somebody who was just totally focused on business and, okay, and was forgetting about everything else.
And that was a bad thing?
Well, in her mind, it was, because it probably made me too focused on that and not as balanced as some people will say I'm still unbalanced, as balanced as I should be.
What did she want to balance it out with? You know, music or culture?
No,
or?
Family, I think, because you know, that would be Friday night. My father was always home on a Friday night. He used to work on Saturday, actually. I mean, he used to travel across London. Because the offices of the company that he ran was in Upper Richmond Road, which was on the south side of the Thames. So it meant going from northwest London, really, to southeast London. And it was a long way to go. It used to take him about an hour and a half each way. So he always went early in the morning, dropped me off at school, and then came back late in the evening and worked Saturdays. Pretty much a full day on Saturdays. Mm. And on Sundays, he would receive the regional sales statistics. It was just a UK company for all of the stores. But no, I had a very close relationship with him, and I used to speak to him, talk to him about what I was doing and what I was not doing. And he died in 89, just after we had acquired Ogilvy. He knew about J. Walter Thompson, knew about Ogilvy. And even at the height of, those were two what were called hostile takeover bids.
Yeah, they were hostile in many senses of the word.
Well, no, they're only hostile to one person. That's the CEO of the company that you were going after. I mean, Jimmy Goldsmith said many years before, that there's no such thing as a hostile takeover. And in our case, it wasn't hostile to the shareholders because, you know, it did make their lives easier. It wasn't hostile to the clients because we wanted to keep them. And it wasn't hostile to the people, the good people in particular, who you wanted to keep. So it was only hostile to the person who was running the company. And in both cases, I think we could argue the company wasn't being as run as well as well as it should be. Anyway, my father in 87 and in 89, up to 89, and he was dying of cancer in 89. He died on July the 1st, 89, and we really cemented the Ogilvy acquisition in sort of about, I think it was May or June. In fact, I remember reading, it was a cover story in the New York Times supplement, color supplement. I remember reading to him when I was trying to get back from Detroit. I was in New York. It was on a Friday. And I had to go to Detroit that afternoon to see somebody who was retiring from Ford Motor Company. And I remember reading him this cover story in the New York Times because he was in the hospital. And, you know, he used to be an avid listener for anything in relation to his only son. And I remember I got halfway through the article and he said to me, "Gosh, this is a long article." So clearly, I knew he was in some pain. Mm. And I flew to Detroit that afternoon, and a little bird said to me, you know, sort of intuition, that I had to get back to London. So I flew overnight from Detroit to London, got to the hospital at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and he died that evening at 6 o'clock.
Wow.
So I was glad that I managed to get there, but it was quite... You know, the doctor said to me, you know, you can wait a week. It's not, he'll survive for another week. But I just felt I had to get back, and I'm glad I did because I was there when he died.
And your mother, you were saying, was sensitive to these family connections, thought you were too focused on business when you went to Harvard Business School.
Yes, and I came out of that. And when my first job was with Glendenning Associates, which was a marketing consultancy firm, a very good one, actually, in Westport, Connecticut. And then, you know, again, as my mother intervened, because in those days, little known fact, you could be drafted, even if you were a foreigner. In fact, Howard Stringer, Sir Howard Stringer, now, was drafted. He was a Welshman who stayed in the US at that time, height of the Vietnamese draft, and he was drafted. My mother said, I was allowed 9 months for every year of education, so I had 18 months. And after the first 6 months, and I was up in Westport, Connecticut, couldn't drive. I was sort of stuck in that because I couldn't drive a car because I didn't know how to, which Americans found absolutely extraordinary that, you know, you didn't know how
completely
to drive.
Ordinary in New York, not to know how to drive a car.
Maybe these days, but not then.
Okay.
And, you know, I was completely marooned, really. Anyway, my mother said, "Look, you're not going to stay in America. You've got to come back from America because I don't want you drafted." So I came back, and I picked up with Mark McCormack, who I'd met at Harvard Business School. Was a subject of one of the case studies. It was called Management of New Enterprise. It was on entrepreneurs. Mm. Anyway, I met Mark at B School at the time of that case study, and he said, "Keep in touch." And so when I decided to come back to the UK, I sort of was dragged back by my mother to the UK. I called him up and said, "Look, anything?" And he got me to start his office in the UK. He had offered the same job to two other people, and I turn up and find that there are three people who have my job.
So all three accepted.
They were all ended up competing against one another in some way, shape, or form. And I spent a few years with him.
Other two spend a few years as well?
Or? Yeah, they did actually. Okay. They did. We were all we're all delusional. And then. After a few years, I always wanted to do something with my dad. And one of the regrets of my life, if not the biggest regret, actually, was that we never did anything together. We tried, and it was absolutely impossible. I mean, despite the fact that I had this very close relationship with him and loved him dearly, and I think he did, he loved me too, despite that, we just couldn't get anything going. It was just...
Business-wise.
It was oil and water. It was amazing.
Was that surprising? They say you shouldn't do business with close family members.
Well, it wasn't doing business. You know, we wanted to start something. We did invest in something together, actually, which turned out to be okay. And anyway, it just didn't work out for whatever reason. You know, he wanted it his way, I wanted it my way, and there was a clash of wills or whatever. So I had met a man called James Gulliver, or other through a headhunter I'd met him, and I became his personal gopher. I was described as a sort of personal financial advisor. That was a very grand description, and what I was his bag carrier. And James had invested in an advertising agency, which was called Compton Partners, which had been injected, is a complicated story, into a shell company, rather like Warren Plastic Products, called the Birmingham Crematorium. It was an old crematorium company. They injected Compton Partners in, and Compton Partners acquired Saatchi & Saatchi. James Gulliver had a shareholding in Compton Partners. And interestingly, he sold down his stock position because when they acquired Saatchi, it diluted the assets per share. James, being a retailer, Gulliver believed that assets per share were important rather than earnings per share. The earnings per share, the accretion was enormous. The price earnings multiple fell sharply as a result of the deal, making it a very attractive investment. But James couldn't get his head around this, so we sold out all his position, but we maintained an advisory relationship with the Saatchi brothers, and that's how I got into advertising. It was serendipity, a very long story, but very, very chancy.
So why did you want to leave that?
Well, because, you know, again, it's menopausal, wasn't it, or andropausal. you know, I just wanted to do something on my own. I mean, it was great at Saatchi's because you could do anything there. You had total freedom, as long as you didn't get any public credit for it. And I thought about what my dad had said, and he was still alive at that time, and I thought it would just be good to have a go. I'd made a little bit of money, and I borrowed £250,000, and together with a stockbroker, we looked for a shell company, what the French call a coquille, and we had some criteria. It had to be about £1 million of value, quoted on the London Stock Exchange, freehold property, no borrowings, a business that was stable, but we could understand, a manufacturing business, because they were cheaply valued.
Not a crematorium.
Not a crematorium. Well, if we had found a crematorium, yes, it would have been fine. and we said we had one criterion was management, mature but not senile. So management that could run the manufacturing business, if it was a manufacturing business, was we went out and built, my partner and I at that time went out and built a services business, and that was it. So we went down to Dartford, which is where Warren Plastic Products headquarters was. We were starving as we went down the... Gordon Sampson, who ran the company, didn't invite us to lunch or anything at Dartford. He said, come round to the wireworks, because they made wire baskets and pots and pans. Come round to the wireworks at about, I don't know, 2:30 in the afternoon, which was just after lunch. That was clear signal he wasn't going to have lunch with us. And we were in Dartford High Street, this guy Preston Rabel and myself, and we were starving, and we saw this fish and chip shop. So we bought ourselves a bag of chips, liberally sprinkled with salt and vinegar, and turned up with the wireworks smelling of vinegar. And Gordon Sampson believed to his dying day that we did that because we wanted to appear as though we were men of the people from the fish and chip shop.
Anyway, you were just hungry because he had
We were bloody hungry, and the chips were very good, actually. Anyway, that's we met him. And it was this is an interesting story. So the advisors to Warren Plastic Products were two companies. One was called County Bank, which was the investment bank of NatWest Bank. And the other was a brokerage house called Panmure Gordon, which was what I call a poor man's Cazenove. Cazenove being, which is now part of J.P. Morgan, being a very posh brokerage, and Panmure's was posh. In fact, David Cameron's father was the senior partner of Panmure Gordon. Anyway, they were the advisors, and Gordon Sampson, when we pitched up and made our pitch about how we wanted to have a shell which we could use as a base, a quoted base to acquire businesses, Gordon Sampson consulted his advisors, and he rang up Pamela Gordon and he said, do you know this bloke Sorrell? Because I was CFO at at Saatchi at the time, and Pamela's gave me a very nice reference. But they were not advising Saatchi's. County Bank, on the other hand, were advising Saatchi's, as well as their investment, one of their investment banking advisors. And so Gordon calls the partner at or the director, managing director at County Bank, and says, you know, what do you think this bloke Sorrell? So the director said, well, it's a difficult situation, because he was in a conflict of interest. He said, let me think about it overnight and I'll come back to you. So the following morning he calls Gordon and he says, well, let me tell you a story. There was a company called Hutchins, or there was a guy called Greg Hutchins and a company called Tomkins. And Greg Hutchins took a stake in Tomkins. And on the day that before he took the stake, the share price was 20. Mm-hmm. And the day after he took the stake, the share price was 60, right? And he said, I can't say anything else, and put the phone down. So he, in a very subtle way, gave Gordon the heads up that he thought this might be helpful to Warren Plastic Products, and Gordon went forward.
Wow. So this issue of freehold property.
Yes.
That turned out...
In the relation to JWT?
Yeah.
Well, actually, we had freehold properties in Warren Plastic Products, too. That's why I thought you were going with the question. But no, with so in 87...
What was this thing that you had with freehold property?
Well, in freehold property, what happened in those days is on the balance sheet, if you had a freehold property, you had, according to the accounting rules, to depreciate it by over 40 years. So you wrote it down mm-hmm. each year by 2.5%. So if you held it for 20 years, it was half the cost.
Right.
But of course, freehold property was rising. In those days, inflation was greater, even as cases today. I mean, by and large, there are dips, but freehold property continues to hold its value, if not increase it.
So if you were to sell it.
So if you had, you know, on your balance sheet, freehold property, you didn't revalue it. There was no rule that you had to revalue it. Some people would revalue it to signal to the market that there was a lot of residual value in there and the net asset value was higher than the book value. But by and large, people didn't do it. So if we looked at the J. Walter Thompson balance sheet, and you know, they'd been depreciating their freehold assets. We thought it was the London building, the J. Walter Thompson building at 40 Berkeley Square.
And this was the first... hostile takeover.
Yeah, in 87. We'd done 18 acquisitions. We'd gone from £1 million market cap to about 150 million in 18 months with 18 acquisitions. And we'd started our first, we'd done two or three in the US. We'd done all the first 15 or so in the UK, and then we started to do some stuff in the US.
And you were hunting a whale here.
Well, yes. I mean, we thought about J. Walter Thompson for a little bit. And JWT in the fourth quarter of 1986... started to lose money, which is, you know, that's the best quarter of the year. It's pretty difficult to do that. They'd lost some Ford business, some Burger King business, lost it to Ogilvy, actually, the Ford business. And we just thought it was an opportune time. Burt Manning, who was the number two to Don Johnson, who was then the CEO, Don Johnson had sort of unceremoniously fired. And we thought it was an interesting opportunity. And We bid, well, ultimately, after 2 weeks, we went from $45 at the first weekend to $50 at the end of the first week, and then we closed the deal at $55. I was advised, or we were advised then by First Boston. Bruce Wasserstein was there. It was known in those days as Bid 'em Up Bruce. actually, he was intelligent. I mean, deals like that are... What the bidder is trying to find is the market clearing price. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit like, you know, so you're in a darkened room and you're bumping around the room trying to find what the market clearing price is, or the bank, the price at which the defending bank has to say to the defending company or the board, you should negotiate. You're trying to find, you know, try and reach that figure at which they have to negotiate. Mm-hmm. And Bruce was, as I said, known as Bid 'em Up Bruce, but Bruce was sound because, particularly with a service business where the assets are going up and down and lift all the time, it was important to get it done quickly if you were going to get it done. And so we moved quite quickly and got it together. Anyway, we 525, half debt, half equity. And we knew that on the balance sheet there was this freehold asset.
But it's like buried treasure. You don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah, well, we got in there. We went in, and Robert Lowell, who was our finance director at that time, I said to Robert, have a look at the fixed asset register. So he went and looked at the fixed asset register, and he called me and he said, well, I found the property, but it's not in London, it's in Tokyo. So he said, I'll...
Tokyo was exciting in the mid-'80s.
Yes, very much so. This is right at the peak. And he said, well, I'll write to our Japanese... I said, no, don't do that. Because we had a banking syndicate. We had two Japanese banks in the banking syndicate. I said, call the banks in Tokyo now. Tell them to walk around, have a look at the building, and tell us what they think it's worth. So about 3 or 4 hours later, we got a call back. They'd been round to the building. It was freehold. And they said they'd lend us $100 million against the property. So we knew then it was worth 200, because anybody who knows how banks operate, they look for double cover. There was another very funny story. The following weekend, a guy called Peter Cohen, who's still around, who was at Shearson at that time, called me. And I, to this day, I never know why he called me. I mean, I knew him from Harvard Business School, but I hadn't really been in touch with him. I was at home in Hampstead Garden suburb in London. And I can see it. I can see me. I was in my study and the phone rang and Peter said, I'm going to be in Tokyo next week. Is there anything I can do for you? So I said, well, I think there is, as a matter of fact. I said, you can go and look at this building, right? And so a week later, I was again the same study in Hampstead Garden suburb. The phone goes, it's Peter. He's back from Tokyo. And I remember this phrase, immortal phrase, US investment banker. He said, I'll give you a quick 100 for it. And I then knew it was worth 200, because any investment banker worth his salt in America would double up. But we sold it for $207 million. We had to pay 50% capital gains tax because you couldn't get out of it. Mm. So the 525 cost was reduced to 425.
Wow.
And if the defending bank was Morgan Stanley, they never got sued, which I found quite extraordinary. It's no problem, statute of limitation, I guess, now. And it was an amazing time. So you had a lot of asset strippers, Hanson, Slater Walker, Jimmy Goldsmith, so-called asset strippers, who would buy companies at what looked reasonable value but was actually quite low value, because they had these freehold assets on the balance sheet that people really hadn't gone into great detail to value. So we were just a beneficiary of that.
The head of JWT had some pretty unkind things to say about
it. No, that was Ogilvy.
Oh, that was Ogilvy?
The head of JWT, John Johnson, really had very little to say. He retired gracefully. It was David Ogilvy who called me an odious little shit, actually, not jerk.
Right, okay.
Because in those days, the Financial Times wouldn't publish four-letter words.
Well,
but we knew that...
We've come a long way since then.
A little bit.
Look at who's leading the free world.
David Ogilvy, we knew, was going to be very upset that somebody had attempted to take over his baby. But in the end, we did a charm offensive. That was also a very interesting story, because in the bear hug letter, it was called a fax attack, because we sent the letter in on Friday night, when the Ogilvy board were up country in New York State, and on that weekend they were moving into Hell's Kitchen, into Worldwide Plaza. So they were somewhat discombobulated at that particular time, but we sent the letter. But the last paragraph of the letter said that we wanted David Ogilvy to be chairman of the combined company.
Hmm.
And we guessed that Ken Roman, who was the CEO of Ogilvy, and we thought the relationship between Ken and David was not the best relationship. It was unlikely that Ken would show David that letter, which proved to be the case. And with all this invective that David came out with, which, the OLJ or OLS comment, after he made the comment in the Financial Times after we launched the bid on the Monday morning or whenever it was after the Friday afternoon, I sent him a letter saying I'd like to meet him. Mm. And he said fine. And when I met him, he said we talked, and I said, have you seen the letter? And he said, what letter? I described the offer letter. And I said, have you seen the last paragraph? And he said, what paragraph? What last paragraph? And he hadn't been shown it. When I showed him the letter, you know, I mean, that last paragraph had been taken out.
Oh.
Which was quite extraordinary.
So he had seen a version of the letter without the last paragraph.
Yeah.
That was hard to do back then. It wasn't just...
Well, however it was done, he was certainly not aware of it.
A copy machine and put a
piece of paper... I don't know. I've got no idea, but he hadn't seen it. So we took a calculated guess that... and even if he hadn't, if he had seen it, we thought he would have been very flattered by it. He became chairman. He was a great chairman.
Did it matter to you that his tone and opinion changed?
Yes, it did, actually, because he wrote an advert. We asked him to write a corporate ad after the deal was done because, you know, there was a fair amount of invective and people made out of it. And the heading of the ad, I've got it in my study back in London, was My First Public Apology. And he goes through this, he said, I've never met Martin, but when I did meet him, you know, kindred spirits. Because actually David's history was, you know, he was English. He was born actually in... he always claimed to be Scottish, but he wasn't really. He was born, I think, in East Horsley, if I remember rightly, in England. And, you know, he had gone to Gallup, sold Arga cookers, and started his agency when he was 40 years old. Mm. Started Ogilvy when he was 40 years old. So there was you know, a sort of Englishman or Scotsman abroad on Madison Avenue. There was a thing. And anyway, it worked very well. And, you know, his widow, Herta, we still... see, not enough of, but we still see, and we still use Chateau Tufou, his pink chateau in Poitiers in the belly of France. So David, you know, we turned him from being anti to pro.
And your relationship with that first bit of invective that he leveled at you?
Well, we expected it. I mean, if somebody seizes your baby... And,
right.
I mean, the fact, interestingly, he had sold every share that he owned in Ogilvy when it went public. Rothschilds took them public in about 1985. I think roughly when we started Warren Plastic Products.
Where'd you get the thick skin?
I don't know about whether the thick skin or not, but, you know, it goes back to school. And, I mean, you know, if you're... it's an interesting question. I mean, gets into sort of fairly tender stuff. I mean, when you're from the northwest London ghetto in I use the ghetto loosely because it mm-hmm. wasn't really a ghetto in London, Golders Green, Edgware, and Mill Hill was upmarket. You probably develop a pretty thick skin. I mean, people say things at school, school in the English sense, not the American sense. I'm not talking about university. I'm talking about high school.
Right.
And in those days, it was a fair bit of invective, and it's water off a duck's back. I mean, what I had to go through was nowhere near what my parents had to go through or my grandparents had to go through. You know, when my grandparents came from Russia on my father's side in 1899, they couldn't even sign their names on their marriage certificate. There are crosses on their certificate, and the four witnesses... who were also presumably from the Ukraine too, couldn't sign their names in English. So, you know, there was a lot of anti-Semitism at that time. And that, you know, I'm not saying that that's why you develop a thick skin or not, but you get exposed to a fair amount of nonsense when you're younger. And anti-Semitism in Britain in those days was much more subtle.
Hmm.
Than it was in many other places that I've come across. And so you were exposed to it.
But you still had the mindset, I'm here to do a job and I'm going
to... Well, I don't know about here to do a job. I mean, in that particular case, to be fair, we knew that David regarded Ogilvy... Oh, at school? Yeah. I mean, you develop a thick skin to it.
You're gonna perform. You're going to focus on what
you're
there to do.
Yes, I mean, but you know, immigrants... you know, you can make the same generalizations, and maybe wrongly, about immigrants now. I mean, immigrants, you know, my old school, my high school, Haberdashers, has, it's the catchment area is northwest London, still a strong Jewish community, but a lot of Indians, Pakistanis, Commonwealth citizens, migrant families, whose parents want their kids to be high achievers, a bit of a pressure cooker. Mm-hmm. But it breeds very similar attitudes.
Now, your three oldest sons,
yeah,
have done quite well, even being removed another generation from that immigrant experience.
Yeah.
Went to Cambridge also.
Yes, all three did, yeah.
Went into finance, yeah. Goldman Sachs, right?
Yes,
and then
all, yeah. And
two
then
left,
one,
right?
One's at Moelis and one's at Man Group, yes.
What do you attribute that to? I mean,
my father, probably, because whilst I was, jetting to and from New York, my dad was instilling nothing to do with me.
So they spent a lot of time.
You know, brains skips a generation, so they've got their grandfather's abilities.
Well, that's good for my sons then, I suppose.
No, I think they, I think my first wife and I, did a reasonably good job.
Did they ever express that they felt like they were in your shadow at all?
No, I never wanted them to. Well, I think if I had, I own 2% of WPP. If I'd own 51 or 99 or 100, it might have been different. But
still,
I thought,
your name's sort of a brand.
Well, I don't know whether they're overshadowed or not. I think they're bright enough to, or capable enough to plough their own furrows or row their own canoes. No, I didn't want them. It's like my dad. I mean, he didn't own his business. I didn't work in his. Well, I did get my first job. He gave me my first job in the credit department in Harlesden, doing credit checking when I was about 16. But I didn't want that. I thought they should plough their own furrow. I think that's important. I didn't think they should be dependent on me in any way, shape, or form for any help. They'll do what they do. They got to Cambridge and Goldman and whatever else they've done on their own merits.
But there was a point at which they would say their last name, and people would say, "Oh,
well, I don't know." Maybe they should change their name, or I should change my name back to dad's name was.
It's nice that they didn't
trade on Sorrel.
It if they didn't, but they had to deal with it, didn't they?
Yeah, but it depends on what you make of it. It can either be a good thing or it can be a liability. It might be an asset or a liability. No, maybe I should change back to my father's name was not Sorrel. I won't say what it was, but he read a book in 1926. He was an avid reader, as I said, the Shakespeare stuff and everything, and the Talmud, and. He read a book by a man called Warwick Deeping called Sorrel and Son, which was actually made into a BBC series. Very good, about a manservant, upstairs, downstairs, Downton Abbey type, mm-hmm. manservant who takes a lot of his money and puts it into the education of his son. And he loved the book so much. And there was a lot of anti-Semitism at that time that he changed his name. He had a very sort of Russian Jewish-sounding name and changed his name to Sorrel. But it was because he read the book Sorrel and Son and loved the name.
That's remarkable.
Remarkable.
He embraced that storyline about investing in
Well, yes, I don't know. I think that was more... I think he did like the book and liked it because it was about a father-son relationship.
Right.
So I think I think you're right. I think there was something more to it than that. But of course, he did that before I was born and did it not because, he might have been attracted to the story because of that, and that's why he had a close relationship with his one and only son. You're right. I think he probably was attracted to it for that reason.
You said that you earlier on didn't have the best work-life balance.
Well, no, I mean, you, I remember that there was this course. It was taught by George Lodge, and George Lodge was the son of Henry Cabot Lodge, and it was a compulsory course in the first year of the Harvard MBA. It was called PBE, Planning in the Business Environment, and in order to get an A grade from George, all you had to do, in our view, was to write, to do a diagram of three circles, sort of intercepting one another, rather like a Venn diagram. Mm-hmm. One circle meaning career, one circle meaning family, and one circle meaning society. And if you reproduce this diagram, you would get an A. I got an A minus on the course, I remember. By reproducing, it wasn't the only thing I wrote in the answer to the case study. But we always used to think that George was absolutely useless. I shouldn't say this, but actually he was very good. And
why?
Because he was right. He was right. I mean, life is a balance broadly between those three things. And people can get two of them right. You can get, let's say, career maybe and family, or career and society, or family and society to the absence of career. But it's very difficult, and there are very few people I've come across that have managed to, because they all compete for time, mm-hmm. Managed to balance all three.
Do you know anybody
who has? My father could do family and his career. He didn't do much. He wasn't a rich man. I'm always described as having come from a wealthy family in North London. I was born in a place called Queensborough Court at Henley's Corner, which was sort of got a bomb on it in the Second World War. I mean, unexploded bomb. Mm. But it's still there at Henley's Corner. I mean, it's a fairly modest apartment block. My father was very hardworking, literally 7 days a week, and came from nothing to what I would say in middle class. But in the true sense of the word, not the way that it's tossed around.
Right.
And now. But, I mean, you know, he did a very good job from modest. But, you know, it wasn't a wealthy background that I came from. It was, I would say, comfortable. But my father devoted everything to family, my mother and myself, and his career. He didn't do much on the social side, mm-hmm. Or your charitable side, mm-hmm. and doing getting that balance right is a difficult thing to do.
My thanks to Sir Martin Sorrell. I'm John Fort from CNBC, and this has been Fort Knox: Rich Ideas and Powerful People. Subscribe on Apple's podcast app, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts are distributed, and please do leave a review if you enjoyed this. And check out Fort Knox Live on Facebook, Twitter, and Periscope, usually Wednesdays at 2 p.m. There I tackle some of the most interesting business and economic issues with a little help from my friends at CNBC and from you. Next on the podcast, Katie Jacobs Stanton is Chief Marketing Officer at Color, a genetics startup. Her experience and insight is wide. She's worked at Google, Yahoo, and for a president of the United States. Get her insights on women in tech and how she navigated DC and Silicon Valley. And go ahead and subscribe to Fort Knox now on your iPhone's podcast app or on Google Play. You don't want to miss that. Meanwhile, share this. Tell a friend. Drop me a note on Facebook, Twitter, or fortknox.com. That's fortknox.com. I'd love to hear from you. And as always, thank you for lending an ear.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.